Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fourth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary Kay Rochford presiding, case number 20-1111, People versus Leonard Logan.
Morning. I wish to extend the apology of Presiding Justice Reyes for not being present this morning. He had a totally unexpected conflict that required him to miss today's oral argument, but I assure you that he will be listening to the audio. So before we proceed, would counsel like to introduce themselves, starting with the appellant?
Sure. Good morning. I'm Deborah Lovey from the Exoneration Project on behalf of Leonard Logan.
And for the appellee?
My name is Brian, Assistant State's Attorney Brian Hodes, on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Okay. Good morning, counsel. And Ms. Lovey, if you'd like to proceed, you may.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good morning. As I said, Deborah Lovey on behalf of Leonard Logan. Mr. Logan has served out his sentence for a crime he did not commit. He is present this morning with us on Zoom and respectfully asks this court to reverse denial of his post-conviction petition and order a new trial based on his actual innocence. And briefly recall, at trial, the only two eyewitnesses, the surviving victim, Charles Jenkins, and bystander Elsie Robinson, both described the shooter as very short, around 5'6 or 5'7. And Jenkins affirmatively testified that Mr. Logan was not the shooter. We now have new evidence of a 911 caller contemporaneously describing the shooter as young, 5'7" and 130 pounds. And against that backdrop, we also have a new witness, Irvin Walls, who says that his friend and fellow gang member, Kenneth Mosby, committed this crime. Now, Mr. Mosby fits the description from Jenkins and Robinson, the only two eyewitnesses who testified, and is corroborated by the 911 caller, whereas Mr. Logan was 28 years old, weighed over 200 pounds, and the state's investigator estimated him at 6 feet tall. Mr. Mosby actually had a motive in this case. Mosby was a gang enforcer, whereas Mr. Logan was not part of any gang and had no motive. Mr. Mosby was also state witnesses LaTanya Payton's boyfriend. Now, in this case, the entire conviction rested on the 7th of 8 versions that LaTanya Payton told the police officers about this event. It happened after she was held for 3 days or over 2 nights, almost 3 days. She gave version after version. And we now learn that she was actually the girlfriend of Kenneth Mosby, who fits the description by all accounts of the shooter.
How do we have the evidence of her being the girlfriend?
That comes from Mr. Walls's new testimony. So Mr. Walls has testified that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, and Mr. Walls has testified that Mosby was the shooter. Now we have, I understand there are some questions about the court's acceptance of Walls' testimony, but what I wanna stress for the court is the independent corroboration of what Mr. Walls testified about. So Walls had external corroboration for most of the stuff that he testified about. His testimony checks a whole lot of boxes here. We have the fact that Mosby fit the shooter's description. You have the contemporaneous description from the 911 caller. You also have Jenkins and Robinson, as I've discussed. And there's even a fourth one, Elber Garrett in the police reports, who lists the shooter as 5'5 to 5'7, 18 or 19 years old and 125 pounds. So you have the only two witnesses who testified in this case. You have the 911 caller, you have this other person in the police reports, and you have Walls all testifying that this was a really little guy who did it. And that fits Mosby. And in the record, you have, you know, a picture of Mosby. And so you have this external corroboration of what Walls is telling us from all of these other witnesses. You also have external corroboration of what Mr. Walls tells us about Mosby being a gang enforcer. If you, Mr. Logan had no meaningful criminal record. He had no crimes of violence. He had one possession offense, but he was not a gang member. His PSI found no evidence of gang membership. Whereas Mr. Mosby had quite the gang history. He was the enforcer of his gang, which is the first time we ever make sense of this crime. This was a point blank shooting of somebody, which sounds like a gang enforcement crime. And does not sound like there's nobody's ever given us any reason why Mr. Logan would have done it. So you have these independent corroborations of Mr. Walls that the circuit court just refused to accept. Instead, the court decided that Walls was incredible by categorically rejecting his testimony. The court, if you go back, and I urge you to read it, because counsel for the state cherry picks several phrases, but when you read this thing as a whole, it is clear that the court is very disparaging of Mr. Walls because of its thought that inmates just kind of lie and that inmates after the fact lie to cover one another. And that would be, first of all, it's on all fours with the Pace case. You're not allowed to categorically reject witnesses. In Pace, the judge said, you know, I'm tired of doctors always giving me evidence and mitigation. And that's impermissible. If a court were to say, I don't accept alibis from mothers anymore, I'm tired of moms coming in and saying their sons were at home, that would be unacceptable. And that's basically what the court did here. The court said, I'm tired of inmates kind of coordinating their testimony. And frankly, it makes
but
no
sense. I don't know if that was exactly the terms, but even putting that aside, didn't the court go through some inconsistencies or credibility issues particular to this witness?
Yes, and it's understandable when this isn't this witness's case, this is something that he saw decades ago, that he might have some confusion about exactly when certain things happened. Things like that, the types of nitpicking that the court does is extremely insignificant, particularly since you have independent corroboration of what Walls tells us. And in contrast to that, the court, I urge you to recall the fact that the only inculpatory evidence in this case that ever existed is LaTanya Payton's version 7, and there is no corroboration of that version. There is absolutely no physical evidence and no witness that ever corroborates her. So in the weight of thing, to nitpick little things about Wall's testimony and find that no trier of fact could have credited was absolutely manifest error. You know, the other side of the scale, you have LaTanya Payton, who inculpates Mr. Logan, and she is contradicted by the bystander witness. Elsie Robinson says that the shooter was the passenger of this car and that there was somebody else driving the car. LaTanya Payton and Mr. Walls tells us that LaTanya Payton was the one who was driving, which makes sense because she was the girlfriend. In Payton's version, she makes the shooter the driver of the car. So her version is not corroborated. And there's no physical evidence that supports it. It contradicts versions 1 through 6 and 8. She recanted it almost immediately. So you have what is a very, very weak inculpation weighed against both the 911 testimony and Mr. Walls and the other new evidence that would come out at a retrial. You know, the alibi witnesses, the evidence against the police officer that was involved in this case. And in that context, to nitpick that Mr. Walls might have screwed up, you know, the date 20 years ago, really does not do much to poke holes in whether or not a jury could credit this person. And that's the real problem with what the court did in this case. The court did not remember that Robinson requires an objective question of whether or not a fact finder could reach a different result after considering the evidence. The court, you know, found it implausible that somebody would want to drive that far. Not impossible. You know, there are cases where courts might say it's impossible to get from A to B in 20 minutes. That's not what the court did. The court said, you know, why would they have had this gang meeting all the way over there? That doesn't make sense to me. The court used all sorts of information about what it thought it knew about gangs, gang relationships, and things like that in order to discount Mr. Walls. The court was obviously very hostile, and if you read the ruling, very hostile towards Mr. Walls. But that says nothing about whether an objective fact finder, the objective test about whether a fact finder in this incredibly closely balanced case with incredibly weak evidence might credit Mr. Walls. And I think there's a high probability they would, given the fact that there's no inculpating evidence that's meaningful on the other side. If there's no further questions, I guess I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, but I'm happy to invite other questions before I do so.
Justice Martin?
No, I don't have any questions, thank you.
Okay, I guess I'll just in closing on this just say, you know, I've been doing this a long time. This is the only case in my career where I can remember a dissent on the issue of reasonable doubt. There were three substantive jury questions challenging this verdict. This was an incredibly weak case, and this is meaningful, corroborative of each other, new evidence that absolutely merits a new trial here. And Mr. Logan is out, he's present here, and he's asking for his chance to vindicate himself.
Ms. Lobe, how is the 911 call new evidence?
Well, twofold answer to that, Your Honor. The first is that, Mr. Logan admittedly, he raised this in his post-trial motion, and he has spent literally decades trying to get that tape. It was lost and it was tendered to the defense in the middle of the post-conviction hearing. So I would urge this court to treat it as new. But regardless, when you have the new testimony from Mr. Walls, which the state has conceded is absolutely new, that has to be considered alongside the evidence, both new and old, in deciding whether or not a new trial is warranted under Robinson. And there's abundant case law on that, including Ortiz and Coleman and some of the other cases cited in the brief that tells you that you have to consider them the new and the old evidence together. So regardless of whether or not the court wants to treat it as new, it should. But I would urge the court to treat it as new. Mr. Logan has done everything in his power to try and get this 911 tape since his trial happened, and he was only able to get it from the state in the middle of the evidentiary hearing, and there's a record of that during the hearing when it's finally tendered to him.
Is the federal habeas actions, I think it was a habeas, still pending or stayed?
It is stayed awaiting this court's ruling, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, Justice Mark?
No, Justice, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hodes?
May it please the court, Brian Hodes on behalf of the people. In this case, the post-conviction court correctly disposed of defendant's successive action for post-conviction relief, both with respect to its rulings at the second and at the third stage, and in limiting what was and wasn't proper evidence at the third stage. I guess the key issue is the actual innocence claim. And defendant's counsel starts out by emphasizing that the evidence against this defendant was very weak at trial. The evidence against this defendant was sufficient. I think, it wasn't the strongest case, but it was clearly sufficient. The appellate court, this court, a prior incarnation of it, obviously found that in a published opinion that was affirmed. That was then litigated for some reason also as a post-conviction claim, which again was affirmed. And even when the defendant tried to argue the sufficiency of the evidence in the federal habeas claim, that was not the part of the habeas claim that went to the evidentiary hearing. In fact, the sufficiency of the evidence was affirmed. Basically what happened was defendant was convicted primarily on the testimony of one witness and one who recanted her testimony at trial. But one credible witness is sufficient to support a conviction. And her testimony was corroborated along the edges. There were parts of it that worked. And she only recanted her testimony. And by the way, her testimony that I'm talking about, what counsel cast as version number 7, was actually, the version that she put into writing and the version that she then told a grand jury. And so it wasn't just another version. It was a commemorated sworn version. And she backed off that only after she met defendant while he was imprisoned. At that point, she alerted the people that she was changing her mind, and she testified and tried to recant and recanted it. And recanting testimony is, there's case law that says that that's inherently dubious, I guess would be the phrase. So that's what the court went into this with. And the court pointed that out at the very beginning of the evidentiary hearing. The post-conviction court gets a pretty harsh rap from opposing counsel here. And for the way in which it conducted its rule, for the comments it made during its ruling. But on the whole, its ruling was correct. They can't show that it was manifestly erroneous. And that's the most important thing, really, for disposing of this. The court went through, you know, the prior proceedings and said, now I'm confronted with this witness. And that's exactly how it's supposed to work. That's how it works in the cases. So it then turned its eye to that witness and determined whether that witness was credible. And the court went through why that witness was not credible, and its reasons were totally valid. It noted, for starters, that he would be impeached by his prior convictions. It pointed out, it cited in the transcripts where Walls is the name of the witness, Irvin Walls, was incredibly invasive about how exactly he learned the name of this alternative suspect who he claimed to be his friend and who also happens to be deceased, and exactly how he got that name. And at one point he testified that he got the name from defendant's counsel. He testified he got the name from the people, from the prosecutors who came to see him. It was all over the place. And the judge was found this, not just this inconsistency, if you're talking about picking nits here. What the judge was especially unhappy with here was he was critical that it showed that Walls was clearly willing to lie under oath one way or another. He'll say one thing and then he'll say something else, and then he was adamant about something else. And then the judge honed in on Walls' testimony about the date in question. And the judge found it very, very questionable that he was able to remember that date with such a vivid detail when he couldn't remember even the actual date upon which he committed the crime that put him in prison for 22 years. And he was testifying about that date, March 18th, 1997, some odd years after the fact. So that was also iffy, and the judge pointed out that at a retrial, that would obviously be a big problem in terms of his credibility. The judge also pointed out that Walls' story, and this is where the rubber meets the road in terms of the complaints about the way that the judge disposed of the case, that he'd concocted a story that was somehow set up to defy corroboration. He used nicknames or generic names even, and said, well, I call every woman baby girl. I was with baby girl. I don't know who baby girl is, who baby girl was. In his affidavit, it makes it sound like baby girl is an actual specific person that he had a long-term relationship. But he said, no, I simply refer to every woman as baby girl. The story about how he got from point A to point B to point C that day, the judge found that rather odd. And the judge found on the whole that the story was put together essentially to defy verification and corroboration, and that given the circumstances through which Walls somehow became involved in this case these many years later, that the defendant had basically orchestrated the whole thing based on evidence that the defendant would have had and information the defendant would have had in prison when he happened to encounter Walls in prison. At that point, the judge, having made this, you know, credibility finding and explained why he wasn't credible and that it was orchestrated, went into made some comments that he'd seen this before, that he'd seen, and that unfortunately it appeared to be a common thing that inmates were doing this. The judge also made a comment that counsel took issue with in her brief about motive. And the reason the judge made the comment about motive was it was invited. You know, why would this man come in and lie? What did he have to gain from this? That was actually the argument that post-conviction counsel made during her argument. And therefore, the judge felt compelled to respond to it. He literally asked and answered his own question. He says, well, what's the motive here? And he said, well, here's what the motive could be for someone to come in and lie, not just out of the goodness of their heart, but there could be a financial back-end motive for a defendant to do that. And after making these comments, the judge went back and pointed out again that he'd made his decision based on the facts of this witness, and that's what he always did. And he said that's only fair. That's how you do it. And that he kind of encapsulated his entire thing, that he felt that the whole scenario that the witness had described was incredible, that the witness was incredible based on his demeanor, among other things, his prior record and the story he told. And therefore, his testimony would not possibly change the result upon a retrial because it was unbelievable. And that was what the judge was charged with doing in an evidentiary hearing. And that is the role a judge has in an evidentiary hearing. And the deference that the judge's determination is owed is significant and should be, I think it basically requires this court should affirm based on that, given that deference. Because the judge.
So are we to disregard the statements about, that this was happening in other cases, prisoners coming in to support one another?
Well, I don't think they had to do with his ruling in this case, if that's what you mean. So in that sense, the court should disregard it. But it's an observation. The judge, I guess, felt compelled by duty to point out that he's been seeing this a lot now. But this was something he wasn't bringing that observation to bear on this case. That observation was based on what he had seen in this case and in other cases. There was not the cases that defendant cites Pace, by the way. It's a weird case. I don't even know if it's actually valid because it was vacated. But notwithstanding that, none of those cases are aligned with this case in terms of judicial bias or prejudice or whatever term you want to use. In those cases, it was very clear. Judge says flat out, I don't like these kind of witnesses, and therefore I'm going to disregard them. And it was usually, one of them was at sentencing, I believe. Judge says, I don't like these kind of experts. They just give shade to bad people. Or I don't like it when defendants come in and say that they're sorry for what they did to their kids. That's not what happened here at all. This judge talked for quite a while about this particular witness and then made a general remark about witnesses similar to this one that he had seen before. But he clearly, and he emphasized this over and over, and by the way, I think he gets the benefit of the doubt as the judge conducting an evidentiary hearing, that his observations and his decision was based on this witness, and that was, I guess you could call it dicta, but it was an observation he wanted to make, and maybe he shouldn't have made it, and maybe the tone with which he was talking, the sarcasm or whatever, maybe that was enabled, maybe that was improper too. There's no rule against sarcasm, obviously, but it does tend to get people in trouble because of the way it looks in written records. And so I think that, we have to give that judge the deference that he is owed. And there's a lot of cases that talk about the particular an important role that a judge plays in a third state's post-conviction evidentiary hearing. They go back to the Coleman case from 98, which I think cites some case called Falkenberg or something. And there was a very, very wise decision that came from another district, I think I cited, called Clark or something, that really talked about the importance of the role that the judge plays and the deference that is owed when the judge sits through one of these evidentiary hearings and weighs and considers that evidence and how important that is versus looking at the cold record where you've got a situation where, sure, we can slice and dice that and take things and move them around and recontextualize them as if we're editing almost a campaign ad or something. But given the deference that's owed and given the entirety of the comment, you can't privilege those remarks at the end over the entire thing where the judge explains why he found this witness incredible. And didn't start out and say, well, he's a prisoner and they're all, incredible. I don't believe any of it. He went through the whole thing and then said why. I think that's what he's supposed to do. Maybe he shouldn't have made the remarks at the end. I think he felt duty bound. I don't know. I'm not in his head. I'm not a judge. Probably ill-advised given the argument we're having right now, but some of that may have been, the circumstance of the whole thing, of sitting through the whole thing and being frankly exasperated by the witness. The witness's testimony was so As I read it, that witness's testimony was so problematic that defendant's counsel had to basically say after that, because of the way he'd talked about the preparation of the affidavit, the defendant's counsel had to fly in the person who helped prepare the affidavit, because the witness had made it sound at one point as if the affidavit had been drafted and put in front of him so that he didn't even, he was just signing something counsel put in front of him. So, I mean, that was how problematic his testimony was that, you know, and that was why the judge pointed out, look, I'm not blaming counsel here, and I'm not blaming counsel's staff. I'm blaming the defendant and the witness because I think they conspired to do something here. And so I don't know if the court has any questions for me. I actually wasn't expecting to get through all that.
I have no questions, Justice Martin.
No questions.
Well, in that case, I would just ask that this court affirm the post-conviction court's ruling denying defendant post-conviction relief. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lovey?
Yes. I just want to remind the court that the lower court's rulings are in no way inviolate. And when counsel says that Wall's testimony defies corroboration, he's dead wrong. There are objective factors in this record that the court can look at that shows that Walls was absolutely reliable. Walls tells us, or at least on the important things, whether or not there were details or confusions about nicknames or dates that needed to get corrected is not the question and should not deprive Mr. Logan of the justice he deserves. So I don't want us to lose the forest for the trees and the details of, you know, whether this date or this nickname was known then. The important things are that Walls told us that Mosby was 5'7 and 145 pounds, as was the shooter. That is corroborated by Jenkins, who saw his brother-in-law or common-law brother-in-law get shot in the head and who himself was shot, who had no motive to lie. That's corroborated by the 911 caller. It's corroborated by Elsie Robinson, who was an uninvolved bystander, and it's corroborated by Albert Garrett. Mosby or Walls also tells us that Mosby was a gang enforcer. That's corroborated by Mosby's criminal records. Walls tells us that Mosby was the passenger in this shooting. That's corroborated by Elsie Robinson, again, an uninvolved bystander who said that. It's also Walls's testimony is also corroborated by LaTanya Payton, who talks about Dino being involved in her earlier statements. And so the important things make sense and are corroborated externally. The court lost the forest through the trees and started focusing on little details about, well, when did you know this? And, you know, who is the girlfriend, baby girl? Like, who were you with 25 years ago? You know, did you pick her up or did you know her beforehand? These kind of little details are unimportant to whether or not a jury could credit. Remember, an independent fact finder under Robinson could credit this really important testimony that says the shooter was a tiny little young guy and Mr. Logan was 6 feet, 200 pounds, 28 years old. And this is new evidence that is certainly meaningful. The confusion that Mr. Walls showed on the stand makes sense when you remember that, first of all, this happened decades ago. Of course, he would remember the date if he prepped for trial. Somebody probably, you know, beforehand told him the date of this. But the other, that he didn't remember other dates when he was standing up there is not a reason to unilaterally reject him or to say reject him as a matter of law, which is essentially what the circuit court did here. And confusion about a nickname, again, I cite several cases in the briefs talking about how that's how these guys knew each other. You know, it was common that they had one nickname, then they had another nickname. And as to when Mr. Walls figured out the nickname, like that's neither here nor there on the important question here, which is we have a man's life at stake here. This man has served a conviction for a murder that was committed by somebody who was 5'6 or 5'7 when he stood at 6 feet. It was committed by someone who weighed around 145 pounds when he stood at 200 pounds. And we have a new witness who can tell us that. We have a new 911 caller who can tell us contemporaneously that that's what the shooter looked like. And the jury never heard that. And even without hearing that, this jury was extremely troubled and an extremely close case. And so, you know, counsel tries to rely on that the lower court, you know, we should always defer to the lower court. But I have demonstrated a number of manifest errors that this court can hook relief onto, including that the court ignored the independent corroboration we've just discussed, that the court relied on outside evidence about gangs and where they are and how long driving takes, that the court incorporated mistakes of fact. The court talks about there being fingerprints inside the vehicle. Mr. Logan's fingerprints were nowhere on the vehicle. They weren't, you know, according to LaTanya, he was driving. They weren't on the steering wheel. They weren't on the rearview mirror. They weren't on the door. The court made a blatant mistake of fact. The court refused to consider all this corroborating evidence. So there are certainly numerous manifest errors that this court could hook relief to. And if ever there was a case crying out for it, it is this one. We have now, I lose count, four or five witnesses who say it was a short, small, young man with low hair or no hair. And if you look at the picture of Mosby that's in the record, that guy was little and he had no hair. The last thing I guess I want to say is, it just doesn't make sense that Mr. Logan would wait 20 years and then manipulate a witness to defend himself. I mean, if it was all about gaming the system, don't you think he would have done that at year two or year three? I mean, this witness would arrive at the end of Mr. Logan's sentence. He served the sentence for a murder he didn't commit. And all he wants is for a jury to hear this new witness who will say, and this new 911 call tape that the jury never heard, that will say, this was a very short, very svelte, dark skinned, low hair man who committed the crime. And Mr. Logan was 6 feet tall. He weighed over 200 pounds. If you look at his booking photo, he had a full head of hair. And the complexion, the physique, none of that matches him. He's entitled to a new trial, and the court committed numerous manifest errors in rejecting it.
Any questions, Justice Martin?
No questions, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Logan.
Thank you very much, Justice Martin.
So I'd like to thank counsel, Ms. Lobe and Mr. Hoas, for your arguments today, and we will take this case under advisement at this time.
Thank you.